Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a Retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 346, we are back with the June 2022 edition of Retinal Physician in a preview episode. We go over some of the articles from this issue. Remember, Retinal Physician can be found at retinalphysician.com and in print for free. We talk about a few topics related to vitreoretinal surgical technology. We talk about 27-gauge vitrectomy, as well as heads-up display for vitrectomy surgery. We also discuss a couple of other topics, including floater surgery or vision-degrading myodysopsia, and end with the discussion of anticoagulants, antithrombotics during vitrectomy and retinal surgery. As always, you can find a link in the episode description that takes you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes. In addition, you can find a list of financial disclosures for all contributors to this episode. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with a preview of the June 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, Retinal Physician is available online and in print. You can find it online at retinalphysician.com. And joining me for this podcast, I've got three retina specialists in alphabetical order. We'll start in Nashville, Tennessee with Dr. Shruthi Arapalli, who is on her way to Emory University as faculty soon. Shruthi, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We've got Dr. Avni Finn, who's in Nashville, Tennessee. Avni, welcome.
Thanks, Jay.
And Dr. Kat Talcott from Cleveland, Ohio.
Thanks so much for including me, Jay.
So we've got four articles. We're going to jump right in. Again, these are jumping off points for discussion. If anyone wants to read the articles, you can find them online at retinalphysician.com. So I'm going to start with some of the surgical things that are discussed. So the first article is about 27-gauge vitrectomy. It's called Updates to and Current Techniques for 27-gauge Vitrectomy. Taku Wakabayashi, who is a retina specialist in Japan, now a research fellow at Wells Eye Hospital, wrote this with Yoshio Nakaba and Yusuke Oshima. And they go through the history of 27-gauge, how it was designed initially, what kind of things 27-gauge vitrectomy platforms were used for initially, and the expansion. They talk, Oshima was actually interesting. I didn't know that he was the one who helped pioneer 27-gauge. 27-gauge actually precedes 25-gauge when you look at the history, but the current 27-gauge we use today is a little bit different. They have a nice timeline that kind of goes through how it was developed, the type of probes that were used, the flow rates, and how they've improved over time, and talk a little bit about the technology and tips for approaching 27-gauge surgery. For example, where to place the trocars, place them closer to horizontal, maybe using a chandelier so that you don't need to torque the eye as much. And it's interesting, they showed some data. It's interesting to see worldwide patterns. In Japan, they had some data showing that 19% of vitrectomies are currently performed 27-gauge, which is impressive, and we can jump into that discussion in a minute. They talk about benefits of 27-gauge, obviously smaller incisions, reduced hypotony rate, and they, you know, essentially espouse that you can do essentially any sort of retinal surgery 27-gauge, including examples to give of primary RDs, diabetic TRDs, biopsies, sutured lenses, scleral fixated lenses, et cetera. So I'm going to start with you, Avni. So I love this article. I think it's very informative. I think for those of us who consider using 27-gauge, there's some good tips and pearls on what to do to avoid problems. 19% seems high to me. You know, I'm not questioning the Japanese data. I'm saying that the data in the United States does not match this. If you go and talk to surgeons in the community, the adoption of 27-gauge routinely has just not happened. What do you think is the biggest barrier, right? And when you think of your own practice or your partners or colleagues, obviously retinal surgeons want to be in the cutting edge. If you're going to use a smaller gauge platform, great. But why do you think it has not caught on the way it has in Japan, for example?
That's a great question. You know, I think that there are a few issues that come to mind for me personally with 27 gauge. You know, one is the sort of flexibility of the instruments or lack of rigidity. And they gave some nice tips here, like using a chandelier might be helpful in terms of illumination and having to torque the eye less than with your instruments, which tends to bend the 27 gauge instruments. I think maybe also, you know, for me, it's the particular cases. I don't tend to use it in cases that are going to be longer. I think that it takes a little bit longer with the 27 gauge vitrectomy instruments. I don't really think the pathology is that different between the US and Japan. So, you know, I have a hard time reconciling the numbers because I do think that in the US, we tend to use these 27 gauge instrumentation a lot less than they do in other parts of the country. So, that's a little more difficult for me to kind of parse out. But I think for me in particular, it's the lack of rigidity of the instrumentation, the slightly longer operating times with the 27 gauge instrumentation. I've even had, you know, doing scleral fixated lenses or lens cases where some of the instrumentation has actually broken during a case. And so when you have an experience like that, you kind of tend to shy away from it quickly.
Those are great points. And again, I think the advocates for 27 gauge would argue, just like with any technique, that if you're not using the instrumentation correctly, then that can happen. I've had that happen. I mean, I've had small gauge probes bend or never break in the eye, but it's possible. Shruti, what do you think? I mean, weighing in on what Avni says, so one of my thoughts would be whether it's cultural or whether it's related to practice patterns or billing, not that Japanese surgeons aren't interested in being efficient, but just speaking about US surgeons, I wonder if some of it is just speed. Like I remember we had attendings who, you know, just there's a little bit of impatience with 27 gauge. They show that the flow rate is better. I think we'd all agree the flow rate is still not quite as fast as 23 gauge if you're clearing out vital dye that's staining the ILM, if you're clearing out blood. And we also have 25 gauge available. I think that's also one of the struggles is people maybe struggle to see an advantage for 27 gauge over 25 gauge if you're going small gauge. What are kind of the biggest reasons? Are those the same ones that you think of? Anything else you think of in terms of why people don't flock to 27 gauge the way they did when 23 came out versus 20?
Yeah, I think that once I had read this article, I actually asked some of the partners that I overlap with a lot what their thoughts were and just why they haven't adopted 27 as much. One of the reasons that came up a couple of times was just cost prohibitive. So I like to use 27 in TRDs as well, but I kind of do a hybrid model where I'll use 25 or 23 gauge and then use a 27 cutter, but you're still opening up another cutter. And a lot of my partners are cost conscious for good reason because they're running a business. And so that can be prohibitive as well. Speed is something that we touched upon, and that's really important, especially when you're in an ASC and minutes matter, and especially for turnover and things like that. And then one of the things that the article highlighted was there's a lesser risk of hypotony. And I'm sure it's true, but I think with 25 gauge, that risk is already pretty low. A lot of my partners don't feel the need to suture most of their wounds. And so I think that advantage is less important to them because they're not commonly facing that disadvantage with 25 anyway.
That's a great point. And I think it's a great point about cost consciousness. Some people may argue, Kat, why not just do the whole TRD 27 gauge? My argument has always been, whether it's valid or not, I'm always afraid of getting caught in that situation where you have extensive bleeding, you're trying to achieve hemostasis, and the washout period for 27 gauge is a little bit longer. Again, they've done studies on it. I think it's not a matter of minutes, it's a matter of seconds, but that can be the difference sometimes in a surgery. If you're trying to keep good hemostasis between a large clot forming and, you know, avoiding that, just doing some cautery and everything working out. Any other reasons, Kat, why you think 27 gauge hasn't caught up? And what would it take, Kat, for 27 gauge to sort of supersede 25, just looking forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think in order for 27 gauge to really sort of take off, you have to be able to show that you can do things with 27 gauge that you can't do with 25, or that it is significantly safer or more efficient, which I just don't think you get. I mean, you know, I don't, to be honest, really use 27 gauge that much outside of like a 27 gauge cutter and like a 23 setup for like diabetic TRDs. But in training like you did, Jay, like we, you know, had a fair amount of exposure to 27. I just feel like 25, if you're looking to make sure you don't have to suture wounds and those sorts of things, gets you most of the way. And I just struggle to see what 27 gauge gets you additionally. I think Shruti brought up a good point is, you know, and we have this at Cole, we have like, you know, almost every sort of instrument you would ever want, but we actually really don't stock 27 setup, because then you have to stock all the 27 things. And if we're already stocking all the 25s and all the 23s, then why do another thing that if people don't use it, they just expire and then you don't use it. So I think that you just have to be able to show somehow that you can do something with 27 you can't do with the others. And if, you know, I'm not convinced of that. And so, you know, I feel like, you know, as a whole, you know, I think that's one of the big hurdles.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, the only you guys referenced a couple of these. I mean, the two big things maybe you can show with 27 gauge instrumentation is maybe the TRD, the getting the cutter between membranes, dissecting membranes, and then for a modified Yamane sort of approach, you know, it's usually done with 30 gauge needles, but if you're going to use trocars, then 27 gauge trocar, you can actually flange the haptics with that incision and have it stay. But those are pretty niche, I think. I think that for your average retina case, epiretinal membrane RD, you're right, there really isn't a certifiable difference. And I think unless you showed some sort of outcome that was better, you're not going to push people in that direction. But let's tie that into the next discussion, which is about heads-up display. So there's an article called Immersive Visualization with Heads-Up Surgery, New Iterations Built on Previous Successes. And this talks about different heads-up systems, including Ingenuity from Alcon, Artivo from Zeiss, and how they are currently available. They talk about the benefits, and we've had many discussions about benefits. We've heard lots of benefits about ergonomics and illumination levels, phototoxicity, stereo. They talk about bionics, which you know, Dr. Fortuna wrote this article, talks about demoing, and bionics is a head platform that you essentially wear in your head that you wear. And he talks about some of the things that he liked and how you can improve the visibility. It gives you a little more flexibility maybe or potential in the future to modify your view. And then education is a big component of what Dr. Fortune does at Bascom Palmer, a lot of us do in our own practices, whether it's at Cleveland Clinic or Vanderbilt Emory. So there's definitely educational advantages. I have my own thoughts. You know, we recently got the Ingenuity. I've been trying to use it in more cases than my own thoughts. I'm going to work backwards. Kat, is this something that you've demoed? Have you used? And again, we'll get into, we talked about 27 gauge, we just talked about what it would take for that to be widely adopted. What will it take for heads up to become widely adopted? Because we already have platforms that are available. I would still say the majority of retina practices or universities are not using heads up for their surgeries.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a really good point. I'm interested to hear Shruti's perspective because I think I made her struggle using Ingenuity with me when she was at Cole.
Bonding.
Yeah, bonding as you get adjusted to the little lag and everything. So during fellowship, I used Ingenuity, and then at Cole, we have a lot of access to heads-up display, often through research protocols. So I've used Ingenuity. I don't use it as a default for all my cases, but I've definitely used it for a fair amount of cases. And then we got access to Artivo maybe like a year and a half ago. So we have that access to that as well. I mean, I think for these things to be sort of adopted, you have to, again, sort of similar to the 27 gauge conversation, be able to show that there's some sort of better outcome than you can get with sort of a standard operating microscope. I have to say that I like it for macular cases. I think the visibility that it gets you is amazing. It's great for teaching. And I've noticed that, especially, to be honest, I'm not the primary surgeon for a lot of my cases. I'm there watching, you know, and guiding the fellows doing cases. It's certainly more comfortable to be able to sit back with a heads-up display when you're at the side scope teaching rather than leaning in to the side scope in sort of an uncomfortable place all day. So I think there's definitely that. I think the Artivo offers some nice benefits. The color and the visualization is more like what we get with a standard microscope. The lag is a little bit less, but I think that the ways in which these systems need to improve is the peripheral visualization is just not great. And if there's already something impairing your view, like hemorrhage, it just becomes magnified in these systems. As well as, like, they're expensive. So, you know, and that's not something you can pass along to insurance providers or charge more for the surgery, unlike what you do for cataract surgery, if you're doing like LensX or whatever. So, you know, those are the things that I think are really sort of impeding people from sort of adopting it more.
Great points. Shruti, how was your experience learning on the Ingenuity as a fellow? And what are your thoughts going forward? Because I'll save it, but my fellows have very strong thoughts about Ingenuity that I won't put my name, but I'll offer.
I mean, I really liked the systems. I think far and away the biggest benefit was for teaching. So you're not splitting your beam. So you're assistant always has as good of a view as you have, which I think is really helpful, because I remember in fellowship a couple of times when you're using the traditional scope, the assistant will tell you, you know, my view is just not as good as yours. So you're sort of forced into switching or giving up parts of the case if you don't want it, or kind of muscling through and wishing that you just had a little bit more confidence that they could see what you could see. So that was really important for me. And it was really important that the residents and the medical students that were shadowing were getting a really good experience. And that I think is so instrumental, because now they're not just looking at the back of your head and trying to imagine what's going on, but in fact, they're experiencing it along with you. I will say that the lag is a little bit frustrating to get used to, especially when you're doing external work. So like an ACIOL and a large scleral wound, it just takes a little bit of time to get used to. With the Ingenuity as well, I felt like you would get this blanching effect when you lasered, and that was something that we had to sort of fight through as well. And then as Kat mentioned, especially with my year in private practice, I've just become so much more in tune to thinking about what's cost prohibitive and what is reasonable to spend our money on. And, you know, it's a lot of money to put into something. And then even the setup for it, I remember it takes time. People have to get there even earlier. They have to manipulate the patient bed. Anesthesia has to place themselves around the bed. So those are all sort of things that may prohibit it from being incorporated into everyday practice everywhere.
Great points. Avni, your experience, any thoughts, anything you've heard from colleagues if you haven't had a chance to use it yourself?
Yeah, I used Ingenuity in fellowship, and we have one now as well. And I think I sort of echo the things that Shruti and Kat have already mentioned about, you know, it takes a while to set up. So if you ever want it or think you might need to switch between the microscope and an Ingenuity system for different types of cases, that kind of may prohibit you from even using the Ingenuity for one or two cases that day. I do think that kind of switching from different depths of field is also really challenging. So for a retinal detachment where you may be doing work posteriorly and then also shaving peripherally, I think that adjusting from one area to another and getting really good clarity and focus in all of those different areas is difficult with the heads up systems. And then like Shruti mentioned, I think doing anterior work is challenging. I think the biggest hurdle, I do think that we're headed this direction in terms of visualization eventually, but I think that the lag is a very big hurdle. And until they can solve that issue and kind of the lag, and then also just adjusting to different depths of focus, mm-hmm. it's not going to be a replacement for the microscope.
Yeah, I think you all made fantastic points about it. I had demoed it as a fellow, and I thought it was the coolest thing I ever saw as a fellow. And then as an attending, I think we demoed it and then we actually have it. And I've tried to push myself to, similar to you, Kat, and Avni too, is to use it, to force myself to try to use it, to not get stuck, to be on the cutting edge, right? Not just to just say it's hard, but I mean, there are drawbacks to it that you hope that with the new additions of this technology would go away. The pros, staffing is way easier economically for me as a taller staffer. It's just way easier for me to sit and direct and kind of do that. And I think you have a better view on the Ingenuity than you do from the side scope on most microscopes. So on the one hand, you're a better staffer because you can tell them what to do because you can see exactly what they're doing. On the other hand, I think the fellows, they like it for observing and for the teaching, but I do think the view is a little bit worse, quote unquote. It's a different view. It's not quite as high quality. And maybe you don't need that high quality view to operate, but once you get used to a high quality view, it's a little hard to go back even 5%. And so I think you're telling the fellow what to do because you're like, oh, you can see this thing so clearly because it's so much more clear to you than it would be otherwise. They're the ones who are actually working. I think it's a little harder for them, especially if they're not using it routinely to adjust back and forth. They also haven't had those reps, right? So I think like you've had 1,000 reps of doing something, then you're not thinking about all those things. You can just focus on the visualization and adjusting the little differences. If they're also learning how to do a fluid air exchange or how to drain, and now they're doing it at the system that they aren't as comfortable with, then I think it's just too many things at once they're trying to juggle. So I think it's sort of a love-hate relationship for our fellows. I mean, I'm thinking forward. You guys talked about things that need to improve. I think, like Kat said, the bigger practical thing is you still need a microscope for this to work. You like if you were starting from scratch, you can't simply buy an Ingenuity and be done. You have to have something to hook the camera up to. So you need to buy a microscope and the Ingenuity. And until that goes away, and I don't know how that would work, Bionics is a good example, maybe how that would go away. Financially, it makes no sense, right? Because you're gonna be using an outdated technology in your microscope that at some point will be incompatible with your heads-up display. And then what if they are trying to sell you both pieces separately, it's just not gonna work as costs become harder and harder to justify. You need to have an outcome measure. I mean, that's why they've chased this phototoxicity thing. And I say it sort of flippantly, but it's a real thing. You can use less light levels. Phototoxicity is real. I don't think phototoxicity is a major threat to the vision of most retinal surgery patients and most surgeries. So it's not moving the needle a ton from a volume perspective and reducing risk. So you've got to show some sort of added benefit. So sort of like intraop OCT, you need subretinal surgery to come through for intraop OCT to be sort of needed. There needs to be some sort of integrated heads up, maybe with the OCT integrated, something that shows that you can do things better with it for people to start really flocking to it. Or it's got to be cost effective in some manner where it makes sense. And again, retina people, we're a small piece of the puzzle when it comes to ASCs. If the comprehensive guy is still using a standard microscope, that really, really expensive heads-up display that you're asking them to buy is not going to be as utilized. If you get more of the anterior segment people on board, then they are also using it. That's really what's going to drive usage, I think. But I don't know that many cataract people who are routinely using Ingenuity for some of the reasons that were discussed earlier by Shruti. But anyway, I don't know if anyone has any additional thoughts on heads-up before we move on, but that was a good summation by everyone.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Whenever I do combos with the cataract surgeons, they always ask to turn off if I'm using 3D to turn it off or to like put it away for at least their portion of the case and then switch back over. I have to say, I think the Artivo does offer benefits more than Ingenuity. Like the lag is so much better. And I just feel like an obligation in part because I agree with you guys. I think this is where the field is headed eventually, you know, and I feel some obligation to continue to use this technology and to provide feedback to continue to get better. I think Bionics is a giant step forward. So I'm really excited to sort of hear about more people's experience there. But, you know, I say that, you know, definitely accepting that I'm in a unique position, right? Like I'm in an academic facility. We have these displays that we don't pay for that they're, you know, on research loan to us. So I am able to use that without sort of having any sort of negative consequence, but it's just a complicated system. And I hope that the technology continues to improve, moving forward.
Yeah, I think that there's still some stuff on the table. Well, let's move on to something a little more controversial, which Jerry Zabog, senior author in this article by Wei Gui, etiology and diagnosis of vision degrading myodesopsia, right? So what is vision degrading myodesopsia? That's the scientific term that's being applied to symptomatic vitreous floaters. Dr. Sabag came down this podcast a few years ago. It's been a while to talk about this. This is gonna be a three-part series in Retinal Physician. I'm curious if we're gonna discuss the other ones. But essentially, I thought this was interesting because it talks a little bit about the composition of the vitreous and why it liquefies and what we see in myopes and what happens with PVDs, like all these things that we feel, it feels like we explain these things probably 5 to 10 times a day in clinic, maybe more. And sometimes I wish I could just record myself and have it play, but I think that's just not very nice for someone to watch a recording when they'd rather hear from you. But we talk about these things repetitively, but it's really interesting to think about the structure and how it actually works. And one of the things Dr. Sabag has set out to do is to sort of define how can you quantify how much a vitreous opacity affects someone's vision. So they talk a little bit about the penumbra effect, which you can see on the near infrared, on the OCT, or on OCT cross-section and swept source OCT, or on ultrasound to try to quantify this. And I guess, Shruti, I'll start with you. I know you do some uveitis as well, correct? So vitreous opacities can be caused by a number of things, including uveitic conditions. It can be really hard to assess how symptomatic someone is, especially because there are things that look like they should be horribly symptomatic that people don't complain about, like astroid hyalosis. And then you have folks who don't have any visible floaters in the vitreous who are miserable. What are your thoughts? I mean, they talk about B-scan. I think B-scan technology, unfortunately, has sort of plateaued. There just hasn't been money invested to make B-scan technology better than it was like 30 years ago. I feel we use the same probe that they used in 1988, but OCT has gotten better, right? So, and I know the uveitis community is excited about other things to quantify, for example, anterior segment inflammation and opacities. I mean, what are your thoughts about how we can better assess these patients and decide who would actually benefit from interventions? Because I'm sure in uveitis, this comes up a lot for those patients who have intermediate uveitis or debris. How do you kind of decide who goes to surgery and who doesn't?
Yes, that's a great question. I think in general, I'm a little bit more sympathetic towards my uveitic patients and their floaters. And that's because I can typically see cell or old cell or pigment or something that I can imagine would be symptomatic. And I think also with uveitis patients, after you've known them for a while, they're really not begging for surgery unless they really need it. And so I have this long-term relationship with them where I just sort of trust what they're experiencing is real. I will say that as a general rule, I don't do routine photorectomies for a variety of reasons. And I know that's, you know, kind of unheard of in private practice, but I get so much other pathology that I just defer that to my partners. I did have an attending in fellowship though that used autofluorescence to kind of quantify the floaters in patients who are really symptomatic. And I thought it was pretty cool. What he would do was take an autofluorescence and then look at the shadow that it was casting on the retina. And if he saw a lot of it, he was more convinced that they were more symptomatic. And then when we took those patients to the OR, I was impressed because you could almost always see that their vitreous did just look like a tiny bit more optically dense for whatever reason. But of course, you're already in the eye at that point, but it did help us feel just a little bit more justified that there's probably something to their symptoms.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. You know, this article is not about treatment, Avni, but everyone wants to talk about treatment. That's like the thing that everyone wants to argue is the discussion. And when patients come to me for this opinion, I kind of tell them there's a spectrum of retina specialists. There are retina specialists like Dr. Zabag, who do hundreds of these surgeries, maybe hundreds is an exaggeration, but they do many, many of these surgeries a year, right? And they strongly believe it's warranted. There's retina specialists like some in my department who absolutely refuse to do this sort of surgery. I'm not talking about uveitic patients because there are arguments for better outcomes in some uveitic conditions if you go clear at the vitreous. But I'm talking about your standard person with vitreous floaters. And then there's the in-between. I think most retina specialists are somewhere on the spectrum in between those two extremes. Where do you kind of fall on this spectrum? Like, how many of these cases do you think are justified? In your practice, do you do a year? What does it take for a patient to quote unquote convince you that doing a procedure is warranted? Or are these patients that you typically send out for a second or third opinion? What's your approach when you see a patient with symptomatic floaters?
Yeah, I probably fall on the more conservative side, and I'm somewhere in between and not doing these cases. You know, I think probably very few a year, so one or two. And what I find is that most patients that present with floaters really just want reassurance and an explanation as to what's going on. And that will take care of the majority of the patients. And then there are those patients who are really symptomatic from their floaters and really feel like they can't function with their floaters. And those patients I tend to follow for a while. I want to get to know the patient. I want to understand how much they're bothering them in terms of their functioning. And I tend not to take someone to the OR on the first visit with me who is symptomatic from floaters. And I think that, I think from a patient perspective, that is probably very challenging because this is something that your doctor cannot see, but you are experiencing. And I think that that's why it's such a challenging issue, right? Like visual acuity, which is what we use for most as a kind of a vital sign for all of our patients, is not reflective of this condition. Even diagnostic imaging, like infrared imaging, autofluorescence imaging, all of, you know, B scan, while it may show us vitreous opacities, it can't really tell us why some of these patients are more symptomatic than others and who is the correct patient to take to the OR for this condition. And so that's why I have such a hard time kind of pulling the trigger on taking these patients to the OR. And I like to follow them. I want to make sure that it's, you know, someone in whom surgery is warranted and who truly does understand the risks of surgery.
Kat, that was a very eloquent explanation. And do you fall on the same spectrum? Are you in between any of her in-betweens that she created on this spectrum? Where are you hovering?
I'm pretty conservative, to be honest. You know, I try and think about sort of where I am in my career too, and how that impacts things, you know. You know, especially like when I started, you know, for me, I just sort of have to weigh the risks and benefits of surgery. And I would just feel so bad if someone had a complication like from this. I took care of someone who had a flutterectomy done elsewhere, and they ended up developing endophthalmitis, like really aggressive bug, you know, post-op day two, and ended up actually developing sort of a cellulitis related to their endop and getting their eye removed within a week. And so, you know, I always think of just bad things that can happen. And I kind of have felt like for the first couple of years of my career, like weighing those risks and benefits, like it's just really hard for me to sort of justify taking that risk. Though, to be honest, like I feel like I put patients with vitreous opacities in that category. But then when I think about my patients who I see with like ERMs, which actually often their vision is like not dramatically different, I just think about that, the risks and benefits there being very different. So, you know, I've been reevaluating this as well. I appreciated this article. It really highlighted ways in which we can sort of comprehend how sort of floaters really affect people's vision. But to be honest, it's kind of like dry eye for me in clinic. Like I want to spend as least amount of time talking about it. And so I appreciate that this article really details ways in which we can better understand how floaters are impacting somebody's experience. But I, you know, at the core of it, just want to spend as little time in clinic talking about floaters as I can.
Yeah, some great points there. The ERM thing, that's a fascinating take that I've never thought about, but I think that's brilliant. I've never thought about it that way, because you're right. ERMs in theory have a lower quote unquote efficacy of success. It's the exact same risk profile. If you look at the RD and tear rates right in the literature. Now the vision is not always good with ERMs, but people are doing good vision ERMs, which is a whole other argument. There's people on the spectrum of that argument too. And probably there's some overlap between where people fall on the spectrum of 20/20 ERM surgery and floater surgery. But I really wondered, Kat, if we had a test or an exam that showed ERMs, I mean, that showed floaters as beautifully as we saw ERMs, that we could point to at the patient and say, yes, this is my thing that I see. I really wonder which would be the more common surgery.
Totally. I mean, post-op for like an ERM, I just oriented the OCT, right? Like even if their vision is not dramatically different, like I set it up pre-op, I'm like, the purpose of this is to prevent the membrane from getting worse, because if we wait for it to get worse, we might not be able to get back here. And then post-op, I oriented the OCT and it looks better and I feel better and the patients feel better. With like a floaterectomy, like I don't get that from my perspective. And so I just rely on the patient. If I had something more objective, then, you know, I might feel much better about sort of risks and benefits. Like I don't have any problem doing if someone's symptomatic at 20/25 ERM, you know, but I do have a problem or more concerns about doing someone with 20/20 vision with significant floaters. So it's interesting.
Well, the one thing again that you reference is different is ERM. The argument that 20/20 ERM surgeons make is not just that the patient's symptomatic, but that if you get to the ERM early, you prevent it from getting worse. There's no study and no one's going to argue that not doing the floater surgery puts you at risk of irreversible floater damage later that you can't come back from, right? So it's like, it's interesting. It's also interesting to think about in the context of clear lens extraction and anterior segment surgery, which I think we all think of cataract surgery as lower risk than retinal surgery. And it is in a lot of ways, but it has its own complications and associated risks with it. And yet I think the threshold has really dropped quite a bit for cataract surgery over the years. You know, the last article we're going to touch on is nothing to do with any of this. This is a peer-reviewed paper. I would say, Kamal Kishore wrote this. I would say this is pretty interesting to read for anyone's out there, just going through how to manage different sort of agents that are blood thinners that patients may be on, antiplatelet agents, goes through the different drugs, including clopidogrel and aspirin and Prasugrel, and there's a whole bunch of these drugs. And I think it's interesting because we've all graduated from med school. The number of years we've graduated from med school is only increasing over time, unfortunately. So more and more of these drugs we don't recognize. And so it's nice to kind of look, and they talk about the newer oral anticoagulants that are non-warfarin anticoagulants, right? So the direct anticoagulants that include rivaroxaban and apixaban and edoxaban. And there's some discussion of the retinal literature, retinal bleeding, other things that involve bleedings, like low platelet counts, et cetera. And there's a nice set of suggestions at the end, kind of talking about, from the author's perspective, best practices, right? How do you sort of assess what things the patient should do? Can you do these? Can you stop drugs? I mean, this is very, very surgeon dependent, but it's interesting to think about. But we don't have that much time left, but Avni, I'll let you kick it off. What's your general approach? Do you agree with kind of his recommendations here about anticoagulants? I feel like all the literature I've seen has been essentially, especially for antiplatelet agents, has been, look, if you can stop it, great. If you can't stop it, if you need to have retinal surgery, you can still have retinal surgery. I think it's not an absolute contraindication. It gets a little fuzzier for some of the anticoagulants, especially the ones where you can't necessarily track an INR to see if they're reversed. I've seen a horrific bleed in an IOFB that couldn't wait, or we couldn't really reverse the patient. I had to take him to surgery when I was a fellow. What is your approach mentally when you say, okay, this is an urgent retinal case. How do I handle the timing of this versus risk from bleeding?
Yeah, I tend to err on the same side that you do. You know, I think a lot of the recent literature points to, you know, we're microsurgeons. Our instruments are really small. Risks of bleeding is very low. I tend not to stop anticoagulation on the majority of my patients. And the only things I will change about my technique is maybe how I'm blocking the patient. And I may tend to do a subtenons block on a patient that's fully anticoagulated rather than a retrobulbar or peribulbar block. And most of the time I'm doing peribulbar, but even then, if a patient's on warfarin or Plavix, I may shy away from that. I found this article very helpful though, in kind of looking at all of those different variations within categories of anticoagulants, especially their, you know, how quick they are for onset and offset, their half-lives. But I agree. I really do not stop anticoagulation in the majority of my patients. The ones I may consider it for is a patient who's had prior bleeding during surgery, maybe in a fellow eye, or even a patient who has had post-op hemorrhage that hasn't cleared. You know, usually for those cases, I do everything preoperatively, especially like diabetics, to decrease that risk of bleeding, like anti-VEGF pre-op, diathermy during the case. But if they've still, despite that, had bleeding, that's someone who I might consider holding anticoagulation, but I really rarely do that.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. Shruti, similar thoughts. And what about if it's something that could wait, right? So let's say it's not urgent. It's that patient who you're going to take once a year for floater surgery with your 27 gauge tiny microsurgical instruments with your heads up display. We tied all four articles together right there. What's sort of your thought process? Let's say they can't stop. Let's say they had a stroke and they can't come off antiplatelet agents. The cardiologist says, okay, they can come off of it in 6 months. Do you wait? Do you just go ahead? Because again, the risk is so low. How do you sort of stratify that when it's maybe something that's not as urgent?
Yeah, I mean, I think the both of you have already brought up some really excellent points. If it's a patient that is on anticoagulation, so I ask all of my surgical patients really thoroughly what they're on. And Jay, you actually brought up a very good point about how every year we're just farther and farther away from medical school. I had actually done a project in residency looking at recognition rates of anticoagulation drugs with Alexandra Rajaskaya. And we saw that with the more newer drugs, there was like a 40% difference or lower recognition rate than with the older medication. So it's really true that even as surgeons, we're just not as good as picking up on these medications or asking about them. But in the case that we do sort of gather this information and we see that they're on it, I don't tell them to stop. I always allow the cardiologist or the internist to play point on that. And that's because, and even if we do this beautiful microsurgery and they're 20/20, if I've killed the patient or given them this terrible outcome systemically, I've still lost. And so I really rely on these other doctors who have a much broader and deeper knowledge of these medications in the patient to tell me when it's safe. I did like that this article talked about timelines. So I kind of keep a rough timeline in my head just to talk to patients about 2, 4, and 6, which falls into like the newer anticoagulants, warfarin, and then aspirin or like the other platelet inhibitors, just to give them an idea of what they're looking at if we do stop it. And if we go forward with surgery and we can't stop the anticoagulation, like Avni said, doing a specific type of block can help. I always make sure that their blood pressure is under good control. I think about my surgical approach. So can I avoid passing scleral sutures? So do I have to buckle this patient, especially if I think they have thin sclera? And if I do, how am I going to manage any sort of bleeding? Like how can I protect the macula, making sure I have PFO if I need it to prevent it from going submacularly, things like that. Suturing my wounds to prevent any kind of hypotony or bleeding post-op. And I've also started, because early on I did have a patient who was on anticoagulation and I had to do a pretty big retinectomy, and you know, they looked great, but day one they had more bleeding than I would have liked. And so now I've just taken even more time on those patients and slowly dropped down my infusion to really catch any of those oozers, just to make sure that I'm limiting any possible bleeding at that time.
Great pearls. I love all that. The other one I would add on top of that would be external drainage. If you're on the fence about externally draining, maybe better to stay away from that in a straight buckle if they're anticoagulated. Kat, any additional thoughts on anticoagulation or antiplatelets to wrap us up here?
No, I mean, I think the conversation was really good. I really like this article. I think it highlights a lot of the newer sort of medications. The only other point that I would make is, you know, sometimes I come across people who aren't on any blood thinners at all. And then I just find that they're a lot more oozy during surgery. Like I just did this woman the other day, had like a tear in a large vitreous hemorrhage who I took and ended up having like a subclinical RD. And she just kept oozing and oozing. And then, you know, I realized she's on omega-3s, and there's supplements that you can actually take, which I feel like lead to as much bleeding as being on some of these like agents. So it's just funny that, you know, you can do as much as you can to sort of optimize, but some people, you know, for whatever reason are just more oozy than other people. I don't think there's a right way. I think part of this is just very institution dependent too. Like we didn't really stop blood thinners in fellowship that much, and we're pretty aggressive about it at the clinic. So it kind of depends on what your setup is. Obviously harder in private practice when things are less integrated to be able to, I mean, it would take a lot more work, right, to get someone to stop their blood thinner if you're at a private practice that's not associated with an academic institution.
That's fascinating. I wonder again, if like you said, if it matters depending on how integrated your healthcare system is. If you're a Kaiser, if you're a university, if you're a Cleveland Clinic, if you're at a VA, it's probably more integrated. The recommendations are flying back and forth versus, you know, multiple people kind of on different EMRs trying to communicate. Well, I'm sorry to keep you guys so late. Thanks for staying up late with me to preview this edition of the June 2022 edition of Retinal Physician, and Dr. Shruthi Arapalli, Avni Finn, and Kat Talcott. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Drs. Arapalli, Finn, and Talcott for joining me for this episode. Listeners, remember you can go to our website, retinapodcast.com. It's retinapodcast.com. On that website, you can find all of our episodes. They're searchable, sorted by category, and archived for your listening pleasure. We're also in the podcast app on your favorite mobile device, including Android and Apple. And you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter, at Retina Podcast. You can always reach us with feedback and to give us ideas for future episodes by emailing us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com or by clicking on the Contact Us link on our website. Many thanks to our whole production team, including Dr. Angela Chang, Dr. Mike Pinacosta, and Dr. Louis Kai, who did a phenomenal job hosting his first episode last time around. If you didn't have a listen, I really enjoyed hearing him talk to Dr. Hadi Kapoor about fellowship experience. Louis is going to be contributing an episode each month, and we love feedback again and ideas for that as we try to incorporate more of our trainees. Also, listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the patients you take care of every day, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreather, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.